Welcome back to Fear or Favour. Nazir, what a week has been in politics, in policing, so much going on.
Extraordinary amount. I've never known a period like this, to the point where, you know, you just don't know what will happen next. And as we're going to discuss over the next few minutes, I mean, it is, it's rare for the public to be talking about crime and justice the way they are right now. You know, obviously, hopefully we can add some flavor and some color to whatever it is that they're discussing.
I was talking to a friend of mine this week who is in the Metropolitan Police, quite a senior rank, and he says that it's kind of meltdown within the police at the moment. They're trying to see what they can do to get public confidence back again, and it's in an utter mess.
You know, I met with the Mayor of London a couple of days ago on a completely different matter, but he also announced, did he not, that the Commissioner of the Met has days or weeks to fix everything. Well, you know, the fact that not being able to do that for several years means that days or weeks might be a bit challenging. But it just goes to show that they really do get the fact that confidence in public, in policing, in justice is as low as I can ever recall. And that is a really bad place to be.
And it goes at the heart of everything that happens, doesn't it? Because if we don't have confidence in those very people who are there to keep people safe and to investigate wrongdoing.
Well, that's it. I mean, we're brought up from day one to think of the police as our, you know, our heroes, our saviors, protecting our communities, dealing with bad guys, you know, being there when we need them. And right now, as we've discussed previously, women are very, very sheepish about involving the police after the murder of Sarah Everard, which is coming up to its anniversary very shortly. And everybody else seems to be wondering whether or not the police are on the right side. You know, are the police working for us or are they working for somebody else? That's a really bad place to be.
And it's not just, you know, women, LGBT plus, you know, we talked about in relation to Colin Port. I think the whole of the society who are the most vulnerable, and of course, policing needs to police the vulnerable. But when the most vulnerable feel exactly that, let down, unable to communicate, unable to share what the police need, because ultimately the police go from information from the public. If they're not getting that, then the whole system falls down.
You've said it better than I could possibly say it. I mean, one example of that is, you know, I've talked to my neighbours and they were somebody tried to burgle them and they rang the police and the police said, just hold on to everything. We'll come at some point. Days and days passed. Nobody ever came. So it's the basics. Never mind, you know, we're going to talk about some of the really big issues, but the basics are being undermined right now. And You mentioned your very senior officer friend. I've got obviously loads of officers' friends, and morale is really low. You know, the officers themselves, you know, I remember one telling me he went to a coffee shop and he was with his family, and he on the next table, people were really dissing the police in a really, really nasty way. And he couldn't, you know, he was with his family, and his family were hearing what people were thinking about the police. And he, for the first time in his, I don't know, 20-year career, felt, am I doing the right job? That really, really troubles me.
It is terrible because, you know, you work in the criminal justice system, I work in the criminal justice system. Those overwhelming police officers are absolutely passionate about what they do. You know, it's much more than a job. It's a vocation. It's a lifestyle. And, you know, they go above and beyond every day.
Well, they're permanently on duty. I mean, you know, people forget that. They, you know, you don't have, it's not a 9-to-5 job. And they're devoting their whole lives and they're obviously putting their own families and themselves at risk on a daily basis. And yet this is what when they overhear conversations like the one in that coffee shop, they question whether or not they made the right choice. I really hope. I mean, 120,000 police officers have made the right choice. You know, we need them. But we've got some serious issues, particularly around leadership, which mean that they are questioning their whole reason for being. It's a really bad.
I think there's two big issues in policing I see in terms of police officers themselves, which is one is leadership and the people at the very top. And we can talk a little bit more about what that means, but also recruitment. When I joined the police service, you know, the sergeant from the local police team would come and visit you and they do a very thorough background check. And of course, to become a police officer, not only did you have to meet certain requirements in terms of size, height, also status in terms of physical fitness. So much of that has now disappeared, and it's not there, and it's open up to people who you probably would say, well, certainly wouldn't have been able to become a police officer 10, 15 years ago. And that therefore reduces the quality of individuals who are becoming police officers.
Yeah, absolutely. I wrote about this in the Mail a few days ago, actually, this exact point. Vetting procedures were really tough in your day. You looked at integrity. You looked at whether or not their belief systems accorded with, what we as a country expect of them in terms of tolerance and acceptance and all of those things. And I wonder a little bit, Mark, whether the rush to replace the 21,000 officers this government took away in the last decade and has meant that they have perhaps reduced the threshold.
That is exactly it, because I was talking to a colleague the other day and I was saying to him, why have we got into this problem? He said, well, simply because there was such a massive need to recruit that therefore in terms of getting the numbers in so that you could meet those requirements, you have to drop the requirements in order to
bring this
in. I mean, one of the things that really I massively struggle with is how police officers can have convictions. I massively struggle with how we've got police officers who are on the front line, who are expecting others to uphold, the law, how they can uphold the law themselves when they've got convictions of all types of offences. Yeah. I really struggle with that.
Well, that is really, really bad. But then, of course, the people who've been disciplined. A sizable chunk of officers will have suffered disciplinary proceedings, potentially upheld against them. They've been sanctioned. Basically, the police themselves have said, you're not fit to be a police officer, but here you go, carry on being a police officer. You and Joe Public, and Joanne Public are thinking, that wouldn't happen in any other profession.
No.
You'd be out the door. If you were a barber and you cut somebody's ear by accident, you wouldn't be a barber anymore, And so, the fact that, a police officer can... in very recent instances, have sex with a vulnerable person in the police station, and then be given words of advice.
Shocking. I mean, they're dismissible offences, absolutely. But I find it. I just think it's disgraceful. I think how somebody can have a conviction and still be a police officer, and the heart of this, and this has of course come up because of a comment that the Prime Minister Johnson has made in relation to Savile and Keir Starmer. And I wonder what your take is how responsible does the person at the very top of the organisation take for what's going on with their officers? And we can relate that, of course, to the commissioner. There's been some serious failings on her watch. But how accountable can we hold the person right at the very top?
The answer to that question, I mean, as you say, I've been doing a lot of media on this subject to try and provide some balance or some knowledge based on my I was there, I was in the room, so to speak. The answer is always it depends. So let's think about it in a different sphere. So you're a surgeon, you're carrying out an operation, and you cut the wrong muscle, right? Yeah. Who's responsible for that? The surgeon is. Who else might be responsible? Well, the trust who employed that person, the trust who may have trained that person, who supervising more senior surgeons. But does the head of the National Health Service based in London, 200 miles away from that particular surgeon, take responsibility for it? There's a difference between a corporate responsibility. I apologize that we as an institution did not have whatever in place to make this happen. There's a massive difference between that and actually being the person that made the error, or the person supervising the person that made the error. So, in relation to the comment by the Prime Minister around Keir Starmer and Jimmy Savile.
And let's just remind you what that comment was.
He said it was in response, let's make a bad situation worse. It was a Sue Gray investigation debate. The police have just announced they're now going to investigate the Prime Minister. And he then says to the leader of the opposition, he says, but at least I didn't prosecute journalist and not prosecute Jimmy Savile. Honest to God, I mean, it sounds like a playground thing. You know, my dad's bigger than your dad. It literally felt like that. And this is the Prime Minister of Great Britain, Northern Ireland. But anyway, that was what happened.
Politics is a bit. I mean, I'm amazed always at the rudeness of some of those politicians in the House of Commons. You just over talk each other, shout at each other. I mean, they're worse than the kids' playground.
Worse. And of course, kids are watching this thinking, do I want to be a politician? Nah, of course you don't. Not when you watch that kind of behavior. So, two things in relation to what that the Prime Minister's right that Keir Starmer prosecuted journalists. If people remember, the hacking investigation, the Leveson inquiry. Again, people need to remember this. The prosecutor doesn't make up the evidence. The police collect the evidence. Yeah. The police collected the evidence in relation to a number of journalists and said, can you look at this and see whether or not they've committed a crime? And so the Crown Prosecution Service put in place a special team which looked at that, and a number of journalists were prosecuted. That's number one.
And let's just quickly address that issue, because I think it's really important for the public to understand that the police's role, of course, is to investigate impartially, gather that evidence, and then present the evidence to the Crown Prosecution Service. And then the Crown Prosecution Service have a number of tests that they have to apply in relation to whether or not they're going to bring charges.
Yeah, the two tests, they're published every year. There's something called the Code for Crown Prosecutors, which you can go online and have a look at. So it's very open and very transparent. First test is perhaps the one people most understand. Is there enough evidence? Is there enough evidence to provide a realistic prospect of conviction? I.e., would somebody looking at this think it more likely than not that somebody would be convicted on the evidence presented? That's straightforward.
Yeah.
The second test, perhaps more difficult, is the public interest test. Is it in the public interest to prosecute? Now, people will think, hang on, if you committed a crime, you should always be prosecuted. That's never been the case in the United Kingdom. So there are lots of occasions. Think of one I use because it's one I dealt with, of a medical student. She's just finished her 6 years of medical training. She goes out on a bit of a bender with her friends. Her and her friends take the wheels off her car, leave them on some bricks in the days you could do without locking nuts. And unfortunately for her and them, the car falls off and causes some damage. She's arrested. The consequences are this. If she was prosecuted and convicted, she would never become a doctor. And we're 110,000 doctors short. That's number one. Number two, she will accept some lesser caution and she'll pay the damage. So would it be in the public interest to prosecute her? I clearly thought not. The consequences had been, there was a response to the consequences. The victim didn't lose out. And she will, I would imagine, never ever do anything like that ever again. So, and it was pretty much a one-off in those particular circumstances. So the public interest test sometimes means that people don't get prosecuted. But the more serious a crime, so, we're talking about, the kind we've been talking about, there can never really be any occasion where we wouldn't prosecute those cases. So the code is still at the end of the day a judgment.
It's quite an interesting test, the public interest test, isn't it? Because you could argue that everything's in the public's interest when criminality has been involved. But of course, that's a different position. And it's quite a subjective view. Is it in the public's interest on the prosecutor, is it not?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a difference between what might be interesting to the public and what is public interest. So another example is if you're speeding along the road, and don't speed, by the way, everybody. The police will not stop you generally if you're within 10% plus 2 of the speed limit. So if you're doing 30, they won't stop you up to 35. If you're doing 50, they won't stop you doing up to 57. Now, there's a reason for that. One is, there could be a margin of error in your speedometer, et cetera, et cetera. But more importantly, the courts would be absolutely and utterly inundated.
Yeah.
Which we could, we already got hundreds of thousands of backlog. But also, people need to learn. They need to appreciate that there is a small margin and no more than that. So, there are lots of occasions in which the police make a judgment, the prosecutors make a judgment that it wouldn't be right to take this case to court. And, on a case-by-case basis, it's done on a case-by-case basis. So, you don't have a general rule. And people, they need to be very open about why they do these things so people can see that they're applying a code and not just a whim.
There's another element which perhaps doesn't get to the Crown Prosecution's position in terms of fulfilling those two criteria, and we often deal with it. I certainly deal with it quite a bit in child protection cases, which is where the victim themselves doesn't want to give evidence in relation to some of the matters. Now, whilst that has been something that obviously does apply and needs to be considered, particularly if you've got parents and a young child or even the child themselves, but there's now been a very good process where grooming processes, the police will often say, well, you may not want to give the evidence, but we feel that it's appropriate and necessary in order to safeguard others.
Absolutely. I mean, there's the nuclear weapon, of course, is that the prosecutors can witness someone to give evidence. So if you are reluctant or scared or whatever it may be, they can actually get a court order, which then is served upon you, and you go to prison if you don't turn up. That's the nuclear weapon. And when it comes to sexual offences and then domestic abuse more generally, vulnerable people more generally, the prosecutors are really, really, really reluctant to use that, and very, very rare. So let me make
absolutely rightly so.
It's very, very rare to do that. You know, we can sometimes, as we know in the Saville case, and I'll go into it in a bit. You can use some influence, information. Sometimes people need more information. They need to be given some reassurance. And once you've given them that reassurance and that information, then they change their mind and they're happy to support a prosecution.
Yeah.
What happened in the initial Saville investigation, that to which the Prime Minister referred, none of this actually happened. It was in a time, sadly, when policing mainly and prosecution as well did not proceed with cases if the victim didn't want to go ahead. And that is a bad place.
And let's break that down. So let's, before we move on and deal with the issues of the Prime Minister's comments to Keir Starmer, let's look back in terms of where this originates from. So the Surrey and Sussex Police have three complaints that are made. And as a result of those complaints that come to them, the individuals are dealt with in isolation. And one of the comments that came out of that review was the Crown Prosecution Service's failure to inform the other parties that there were other people making complaints. And of course, the reason being why that's so important is that it makes a massive difference between you being isolated on your own and being supported. Now, it's important you don't give details of what those other allegations are, other than to simply say that there are other victims who have come forward. Now, that is now accepted within the Crown Prosecution Service as being a correct way to proceed. But it wasn't, was it?
No, absolutely not. Back then, there was this view, which was wrong, this view that if you told one person there was another victim, that you actually would perhaps be, in effect, influencing them about the evidence they gave, that you'd be contaminating their evidence in some way. It would be easier for them to say whatever they say, knowing that somebody else is going to say something else, but similar. So I think that was part of it. But to clarify a little bit, Mark, the decision by the prosecutors in this case followed on from the police's decision not to tell. It was the police who told victim 1, 2, 3, and 4 that there wasn't another victim 2, 3, or 4. By the time it got to the prosecutor on two occasions, one in 2008 and another in 2009, the settled view of the officers was that these victims would never give evidence and were very reluctant to do so, more than reluctant, just wouldn't give evidence. And the prosecutor took that as read rather than do what they would do now, which is to question it. What information have you given? What reassurances have been given? Et cetera, in the hope that they would ultimately be able to influence the decision taken by that victim not to give evidence. So
certainly known in relation to one of those victims, because obviously I was very centrally involved in it, is that had known other people were involved, their view very much would have been to have run with it.
100%. That's Alison Levitt, QC, now Judge Alison Levitt, carried out this review in 2013. She spoke to three of the four victims, and they said, had we known that there was another victim, we may have given our evidence, we may have supported the prosecution. The fact that we weren't told was a critical factor in whether or not they were prepared to proceed. We're using obviously hindsight, and they are obviously using hindsight. But again, experience tells me and you that generally you get a reassurance from the fact there are other victims.
Yes.
It makes it, it's not just you. I mean, if you look at what they were saying, the victims were saying, I don't want to be in that courtroom being destroyed by Jimmy Savile's lawyer on my own.
Yeah.
You know, if there was another person, then it would be so much easier. Some easier.
And also evidence-wise, in terms of Sima fact evidence, it's always a very crucial part of any case, because, of course, what we know is child abuse victims, by and large, are offended against in isolation. It's the offender.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's similar fact and bad character, because it shows, he's got propensity to do this kind of thing to young girls. But also, as you say, similar fact means, for example, if you were to say that I touched you on the head and nobody believes you, but then somebody else came along, he always keeps touching people on the head.
Yes.
It shows a pattern of behavior, and it therefore corroborates. You don't need corroboration for sexual assault. And that was another problem in this case, by the way. But you don't need corroboration, but it does actually support your account that somebody else has said he's done something similar.
Yeah. And really important, because, you and I dealt with an awful lot of offenders in relation to sexual abuse. And there very often is characteristics that they display which are repeated across their different victims, because what they do is they carry out that offence, and they there's some familiarity with other offences they've committed. And therefore, that similar fact evidence can be really compelling.
Yeah, 100%. Do you remember the historically, there was the murder of wives in the bath?
Yes.
The brides in the bath case. It's a long, long time ago. We may talk about it in the future if people want us to. But, his wife dies having drowned in the bath. And everybody goes, oh, that's a terrible, terrible thing that's happened to you. And then, of course, hang on a minute, his last wife died by being drowned in the bath. He's either got some ridiculous bath, or there's something more sinister going on. And so, that's a classic example where on its own, that one incident might have some innocent explanation, but when it's a constantly happening, I was listening, watching some conversations around phones being wiped in the last couple of days. If in the Rebecca Vardy, Glenn Rooney libel case, evidence came out that Rebecca Vardy's agent's phone, when the defense, Glenn Rooney, asked for the data on the phone ended up in the North Sea.
Yeah, by accident.
By accident, of course. The Prime Minister's phone, when he was asked for some information around wallpaper in his Downing Street, apparently that was wiped.
Yeah.
And then Cyrus Ford Office investigation, which I was reading about, the chief investigator's phone has been wiped twice in the last year. All of it, of course, absolutely innocent. There's obviously an innocent explanation to all of this. But, and no backup ever for any of these messages, by the way. The point about similar fact is that one thing happening might be a bit of a coincidence. One might be interesting. Two might be a coincidence. But three or four, you begin to think there's a pattern developing here.
Yeah. No, it's truly shocking, isn't it? And I think one of the elements that come from this is when we look at Keir Starmer. So Keir Starmer is on watch. He is a DPP whilst the decision is made in relation to not prosecuting Savile. How accountable do you think he is for that? Is it right that Boris Johnson brings that out into the public domain in the manner that he did and in the way that he tried to make the correlation?
No, it wasn't. I mean, what I've tried to do, and you need to go back to the Levitt report if you're really interested. Our listeners need to, if they want to, it's 129 pages. Good luck to you. But it tells you this. It tells you that victims came forward in 2007 and 2008 to, as you say, Surrey and Sussex Police. They made statements or equivalent of allegations against Jimmy Savile. The police officers told them or didn't tell them there were other victims. They expressed a reluctance about coming forward. Keir Starmer only became DPP in November of 2008. All the critical decisions in this case, the things that went wrong, the failures that we've just touched on, happened before he even became DPP. The initial advice given by the prosecutor not to proceed was, again, before Keir Starmer became DBP. The only thing that changed was, and this again is ridiculous, Jimmy Savile was allowed to decide when he would be interviewed.
Yeah.
As you will know from your program, I think a year or so passed where the police were saying, are you available for us to have a chat with you? I mean, crying out loud, you wouldn't do that with anybody else. But anyway, and so the interview with Jimmy Savile took place after Keir Starmer had been made DPP, and the prosecutor, the regional prosecutor in the southeast of England, finalized his advice after Keir Starmer had been DPP. But all he was doing was regurgitating his original advice. So the bulk of the work in that case and the bulk of the failures in that case happened before Keir Starmer was DPP at all. And then the broader point you made earlier on about what does a corporate responsibility amount to? I'll try and get people to understand what CPS is like. At that time, there were 800 and something thousand prosecutions a year. We had about 6,000 staff, something like that. We were broken into regional areas. Where was I in 2008? I was in London at the time. I was responsible for London. Everything that happened in London was mine. Even if I didn't know anything about it, my job was to ensure that the lines of accountability were there and lines of information were there, so people were able to discuss with me high-profile cases, et cetera, et cetera. And then ultimately, they will make a judgment, but at least I'm aware of it. But again, the buck stops with me as at that time the acting chief for London. But never, ever would I ever tell the DPP what I was doing. You know, there were cases which I can't talk about because I didn't prosecute them, or that we decided not to prosecute them, including this very senior figure in the Conservative Party, by the way, who allegations of sexual abuse were made against, where we decided there wasn't enough evidence to prosecute him. He was then told that there was no prosecution. Keir was never aware of it, never told about it, because he didn't need to know. You know, he has other responsibilities. You know, I'm being paid, and prosecutors are being paid a fairly good salary to be able to make these decisions. And in Savile's case, as Levitt pointed out, Keir had, never mind having nothing to do with most of the case, was certainly not aware of the decision taken by that prosecutor in 2009.
And I think that's a really important point to make, because when we equate that across to the Commissioner, Metropolitan Police, and other leaders within their organisation, we have to understand that decisions are made every day, and decisions are made by different ranks across the whole of the individual organisation they're in. And what you can't have is the person at the very top involved in across all of those decisions. And of course, they will have to.
You can't.
Certain.
So, you can't. I think the argument is that this is a high-profile case and Keir should know about it. Now, the problem with that is that there are lots of high-profile cases. You know, I prosecuted.
There was, you know, I've dealt with loads of high-profile cases across the time. And in terms of policing, you know, would Savile have made its way to the chief constable of an individual police force at the point to which he was being arrested? No. He would have sat.
No, that really it depends, doesn't it? It always. I say the answer. It depends. If you've got a policy in place, and one of the things that happened post Savile and post your investigation and Levitt's report was that there is now a process in place which Keir brought in, which meant that even if it's a minor case, even if it's road traffic or something, but it involves Prince Charles, not that he's ever drives a car. I need to know about it. You know, there ought to be a message sent to my office saying that file has arrived in relation to X. Mm-hmm. That is what Keir brought in. Before Keir, that didn't exist. We can talk about, we've got to think about the reality at the time. There are so many, you know, this country's got lots of high profile figures.
Yeah.
And you've got to trust people, the surgeon on the table, to make the decisions that they are paid to make.
Yeah. It's where that person sits in the hierarchy. I mean, I can totally understand members of the royal family get into that position. And in police, in fact, policing for a long time has got very good set up in terms of gold command, you know, dealing with high profile cases and just considering them at weekly meetings or when appropriate. But Savile, at the time, you know, there are other individuals that we would have dealt with within the police service. who could equally have been in a position. I remember when Max Clifford first came to our attention in the police service, and I remember being called in by my chief superintendent, and he said to me, "Mark, we've got this complaint from actually it had come in from Max Clifford about Jonathan King, and Max Clifford had said that there's an allegation against Jonathan King, and Max Clifford has advised us in relation to it, but because of course who Max Clifford is, we can't just ignore it." Anyway, but that didn't go up to the chief constable level. That was dealt with by, you know, the head of CID. And I think you're having to make these very, very difficult decisions on a daily basis in terms of where does that profile sit. You can't have that responsibility sat with the person at the very top, and none more so than if you were simply passing that information on to them. And we've seen this in other inquiries, is that in order for them to be accountable for the decision that's made by someone below them, they have to be aware of all the facts. And more often than they're not.
They're not. It's, as you say, most often I would have submitted something to Keir or the DPP, whoever it was that I was working with, and sometimes the Attorney General, by the way, the Minister, but it would just be for their information. I can't think of the occasions. I'm trying to think of my head. You know, I dealt with 800,000, 900,000 prosecutions during my career. I can think on the fingers of one hand the cases that I referred up to the DPP for a decision, i.e. I've made a decision, can you confirm it? Yeah. The bulk of those are taken by me or the staff that I'm responsible for. And that's the way it should be. You can't expect people to grow in experience and accountability if they don't have the ability to be accountable and to have the experience of dealing with these cases. And it's rare, really rare, for the DPP to be aware of it. And the sad thing in this case, here, in the, what Boris Johnson said, is that as the Prime Minister of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, he would know what the internal processes are.
Yeah.
The Attorney General is the minister who superintends the Crown Prosecution Service. The Attorney General sits in cabinet, or at least advises cabinet. And so the Prime Minister, when he was in Mayor of London, he would have undoubtedly had I did have meetings with him then. So it's important to know that he knows how the system operates. So that playground comment that we talked about earlier on was exactly that. It was meant for a different audience than the actual audience that, the people who are familiar with the justice system. It was aimed at people to somehow suggest to them that there's something wrong with that particular individual and that system. And that, all it does, it goes back to the very first point that you and I made, is it damages confidence in the system.
And of course, we've now got a position where, as a result of Sue Gray's report investigation, the Metropolitan Police have launched their own investigation. And we've spoken many times, and we both absolutely agree and critical that the police were the very people who should have done that investigation. It wasn't down to Sue Gray's investigation.
Yeah.
They were there, absolutely. And we've now got a position where they've launched this investigation and they're going to send a questionnaire out to 50 people to have their view in respect to what's taken place. I mean, pretty much a debacle, this whole thing by the Metropolitan Police and by the
commission. It is. I mean, this is one of those occasions where, given the nature of the allegation, the fact it beggars belief the commission did not know that there was the decisions taken about no investigation prior to the recent one after Sue Gray's report would have involved her decision making. That's the difference between this and Keir Starmer, because of the nature of the allegations. And we're now at the stage, as you say, of these questionnaires going out. They're the equivalent of that notice that you get if you've gone through a speeding camera. Do you admit that you were present? If you admit you were present, do you want to give some more detail about that? If you don't admit you're present, then potentially you could be summoned to a magistrate's court where the evidence that the police have will be presented against you. So that's basically where we're at. They've been given this notice of intended prosecution, where they are able to confirm or deny, or admit or deny whether they were there, and potentially then fixed penalty notices would follow. And the Prime Minister himself may well get up to 6 fixed penalty notices. Now, what does that mean? What it means is this. You get a fixed penalty notice because a criminal act has occurred, but the police have decided that they will not prosecute you. That's what it says. It doesn't. So you are guilty of a criminal act if you admit what the content of the FPN is. And if a Prime Minister of Great Britain and Northern Ireland admits up to half a dozen criminal acts, well, there should be consequences, shouldn't there?
Mm. Do you think, and I know this is a big if, do you think it's going to result in some action, or do you think simply because of the sheer status and of this, nothing's going to happen?
Well, you know, I don't know the answer to that question, Mark. I know what should happen. What should happen is what we've learned while we have a podcast called Without Fear or Favour, is that people should simply follow the evidence. The evidence takes them where it takes them, and they act accordingly. I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful that the police will, having followed the evidence, and there seems to be a lot of it, you know, all these photographs are surfacing now, that they will then issue the notices accordingly. I've said it before, and I'll say it again. I lost my brother to COVID. I couldn't attend his funeral. I couldn't be there in the last days of his life. As a family, we've not been able to mourn. My mother died from a broken heart 3 months afterwards. Again, I wasn't able to have the same level of connection as I would do because we complied with the rules.
Yeah.
And at the same time, the Prime Minister and the government were having party after party after party. Mm. That's why it's important to those of us, all of us, that some action is taken.
And the Commissioner on borrowed time?
Yeah, I think the Mayor has made it very clear, but it's very complicated because the Mayor and the Home Secretary are both responsible for the Commissioner's role. And of course, the Home Secretary's extended her contract by 2 years. Yeah, she's very much being observed now in the hope and expectation that either she leaves or she resigns or she's told to go, or she does some magic trick that suddenly restores confidence in policing.
I think part of the arrogance of politicians is a comment that was made by the leader of the Commons, Mark Spencer, who said, real people don't care about the number 10 lockdown parties. I just don't think that's true. I think
that's just not true. I mean, that just goes to show how remote you are from real life. You know, real people do care. Real people have made sacrifices and continue to make sacrifices. Real people have suffered loss. And for a senior government official to somehow suggest that what you think and what you believe isn't what you should think or what you should believe really is the height of arrogance.
Something else that was, in terms of policing, which was announced this week, which is very significant, was the reduction in the threat level reduced from severe to substantial in terms of terror attacks, saying that it's, as a result of that, it's considered likely rather than highly likely. That's very positive, isn't it?
It is really good news that the threat level has been reduced. But of course, it means that we're still mindful of that there will be an attack of some kind. That's the saddest news we all need to be aware of, but it's less likely than it was maybe a week ago.
It's very sad that leading the news at the moment are the very people who are the, you know, the lawmakers, the politicians, the people that we should be looking up to and holding accountable for making decisions. They are the centre of the news. That's not how it should be.
No. If you're in the news, that's a bad place. You know, you should be there providing, I don't know, we look to politicians to, as we have done through war and conflict and times of real hardship, to be the reassuring voice, you know, to provide us with stability and security. And I'm afraid we're not there. We look at, they were just all over our news programs. You know, they are constant, the next development, the next disclosure, as we said earlier on, playground banter. It is not where we would want our politicians to be.
And I just want to end on a note. The Prime Minister is talking in terms of removing all the lockdown sanctions. Something that came very close to home to me yesterday, there was a young girl, 17-year-old girl, who was the best friend of a very good friend of mine. And she went missing yesterday during the course of the day before yesterday, during the course of the day, and yesterday her body was found, and they're not looking for a third party. But one of the things that's come out in relation to that was this young girl had suffered some forms of bullying more recently. And I equated that to a conversation I'd heard last week about a young boy who had moved school, and he was in the playground on his own, kicking stones around. And one of the other young lads, whose mother told me and said, look, he is on his own all the time, but I can't go and talk to him because he's not in my bubble. And therefore he sits alone. And I just think we as a society have to really acknowledge that whilst as adults we have suffered mental health around some of the lockdown issues, the impact on children has been absolutely significant and still is ongoing. And I just wonder what your thoughts are around, has a time come now that's absolutely right that we try and deal with COVID as a flu or whatever it is, and try and get some normality back as quickly as possible because of the impact on children?
Well, I think we're getting there. Virtually all of us have been vaccinated. The various variations that are coming through aren't as serious, thankfully, as the initial ones. But your broader point about mental health is one that I'm very conscious of. You know, I'm a chair of a college in Manchester, and the young people are being, some of them are much more disruptive than they were a year or two ago. They've lost 2 years of their life. They may be 16 now, but they're still act like 14-year-olds, whatever that means. They've forgotten maybe how to diffuse tension. They've forgotten how to have conversations. Those are really, really important things. And I think your broader point, Mark, is that, you know, we've forgotten young people in all of this because we've been focusing so much on the elderly and those who are greatest risk of harm. But we need to get back to what we're good at as a society, which is looking after each other.
Absolutely. Yeah. And talking.
Talking. There's no excuse. We've got to carry on and must do what we're doing. Keep talking.
Talk and listen. You know, sometimes people just want to talk and just want to be heard. You know, they don't want you to give them a view, tell them how to fix it. They just simply want to talk.
It's the least valued skill of a leader is listening. We don't, if somebody sits in a room for an hour just listening, we think, why aren't you talking? You know, we may be learning a great deal. They may be learning a great deal, which they then put into operation. So absolutely, let's keep listening as well.
Brilliant. Well, listen, is it, as always, it's fascinating. I think what has come out of, you know, since we started doing these podcasts is the value of being absolutely honest and talking from the heart. You know, we both have considerable amounts of experience, and neither of us will shy away from giving a view and being very practical in terms of how we address some of those issues as well. And I know the feedback that we have received from listeners has been incredibly positive around that.
Absolutely. We need more ideas. Please keep throwing them in, and maybe we can talk about them in some future event, or some future podcast. But I love these conversations, and I think we need to have more of them, and hopefully better informed from the people that are listening to them.
Brilliant. Well, listen, thank you very much. And thank you as listeners. Do please continue to listen, tell your friends, and subscribe to Fear or Favour. You can contact us via our Twitter page or via our website. And we look forward to speaking to you next week. Nazir, look after yourself and your family, and we'll speak next week.
Very best. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this week's podcast. Do please tell your true crime friends, and it's important that you subscribe to our channel. If you've got any thoughts or you just simply want to get in touch, you can do so via our Twitter page, Fear or Favour, or go to our website, www.fearorfavour.com. The series is edited by Martin Kayes, the music by Dylan Epega. Fear or Favour is an original true crime podcast in association with Audioboom.